Well, good afternoon, friends, and thank you so much for coming to, first to RTS Atlanta. Let me welcome you there. And then to the Center for the Study of the Bible and Ethnicity, hosted on RTS Atlanta's campus. Hey, we're glad to have you here. And this is our third lecture in our Grimke series. And one of the things that the Center for the Study of the Bible and Ethnicity focuses on is how Christians will live in what is very much a new day and a new climate for Christianity in America. We are teaching people to focus on not necessarily being American Christians, but being Christians in America, where we are focused more on the fact that we do have a dual citizenship, and that we have our responsibility is of how we behave and how we act here on earth is largely determined by the fact that we have an eternal perspective on how history is going to come out. So to that end, today we have, I'm delighted to introduce a young man named Justin Gibney. He's a part of my personal 2019 plan to learn from young people. Yes, I'm older than I look. I'm learning from young people throughout 2019, and Justin he's not an Atlanta native. I just found out you came from Colorado in my research, but he has been living in Atlanta, in the city, for quite some time. He's an attorney and a political strategist who has his hands in many pots here in the city. Justin has managed successful campaigns for elected officials in the state and referendums that relate to the city's transportation and water infrastructure. Just one of the many pots. He's actually a former Vanderbilt University football player and law student, was pivotal in the all-comers case at Vanderbilt. Oh, okay. You were on the board at the time. And he's participated in Lead Atlanta, Outstanding Atlanta, the Georgia Bar Association's Leadership Academy, and the Urban League. And he's currently the president of the AND campaign, and he's going to explain to us what that is and the biblical principles that undergird their position on civic engagement and how they're promoting a new Christian politics based on God's transcendent perspective of earthly events. You can hear Justin and his partner, Michael, his cohort, Michael Ware, on the Church Politics podcast. That's on iTunes. Man, you stay doing the most, my brother. You're busy. You're a busy man. You need a lot of prayer. His Twitter bio has this order, though, and I think that this is really important. Christian, husband, and father. And that order is vital to the work that he does and the life he strives to live. And we're also proud to say that he is a student here at RTS Atlanta. He's a father to three, two already here, one on the way coming in May, and husband to the lovely Summer. So I will introduce you to Justin Gibney. Come on and give us a word. And then we'll have a question and answer afterwards.
I appreciate that very kind introduction. I'd like to thank Karen Ellis, Dr. Ellis, Dr. Richard, and all you for them for having me, and all you for being here today. I'll be talking to you a little bit just about, you know, the AND campaign a little bit, but more so about how faith should drive our politics, And I think sometimes we think faith is driving our politics when sometimes it's actually ideology. And so we want to make that distinction there. Now, while Christians should do our best to abide by the laws of the land, I think we get that. Ultimately, we're bound to an authority and principles that supersede that of the state, and that we've seen that throughout. You know, we see it in the Bible, we see it throughout history, and sometimes it causes a conflict for us, right, with the state. This doesn't, to me, minimize the church as being political, but it certainly says that there are political implications to the gospel, that the gospel cannot be excluded from our political life. If the gospel transforms and saturates every aspect of our lives, then our civic interaction should be no exception. Christian politics should display an application of the faith, a testimony or a public profession of what we truly believe, and what price we're willing to pay to put the compassion and conviction of the gospel into practice. It's Paul before the Sanhedrin, right? It's Paul in Athens using the speaking to the folks in Athens. It's Amos confronting Amaziah the priest, Daniel refusing to bow, right? These are the things that we should experience in our politics. Christian politics can't primarily be about self-interest. There must be a certain sacrificial and upright spirit about it. It should be unmistakable. It should not be obscured by partisanship or political ideology. And I think, you know, all the biblical contexts have something to say and something to learn to make this work. One of those biblical contexts, the traditional black church, I think our civic engagement historically provides an imperfect but helpful example in regard to how politics and advocacy should be driven by faith. I think it's a context that's helpful. Specifically during the civil rights movement, which was absolutely a faith-driven effort. Make no mistake. Now, if you listen to some of the great speeches during that movement, if you listen to the music, the spirituals during that movement, you will hear this spirit. And I'd like to read lyrics from one of the songs that come to mind in that regard. So listen to this closely. God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who have brought us thus far on the way, thou who have by thy might led us into the light, keep us forever in the path, we pray. Lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee. Lest our hearts, drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadowed beneath thy hand, may we forever stand true to our God and true to our native land. That is the last stanza of Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem. It was written by James Weldon Johnson in 1899, and if you were listening closely, surely you recognize that it's actually a very a sound reflection of Christian doctrine. Johnson was a poet. He was also a lawyer, an educator, and an activist. But what was most interesting to me and when I was learning about James Weldon Johnson was that he was agnostic, which is to say that he was unsure about God. He wasn't a professing Christian. So this means that this recipient of common grace was merely repeating the faith that he had observed in others through Christians, many of whom were in the justice movement of his time. You see, he had been hanging around to people who were bearing such a clear and profound witness that he was inspired and was able to articulate it himself with precision. He called this, in fact, his greatest work. He'd been in such close proximity to the faithful that he couldn't help but be riveted by the source of their courage. It provided a framework and a language to describe a spiritual fortitude that was otherwise inexplicable. Again, if you listen closely to that verse, you hear that it testifies to God's sovereignty, to his active role in our daily lives, and it credits God for all affirmative steps towards freedom. It not only understands God as a liberator, but as a father to be obeyed. And it acknowledges the human tendency to be led astray when left to our own devices. It begs God not to leave us to our own conclusions, experiences, and feelings. It confesses that our way is not God's way. Oh, Lord, don't subject us to our own solutions. You see, this ethic in the song was transcendent. Matter of fact, those of us who are staunch adherents of conservatism or liberalism will have a hard time fitting the tenets of our ideology into the theological framework that inspired the civil rights movement, that fueled abolitionists. You see, this anthem begins with God and faith, and it ends with God and faith. And so, too, should Christian political engagement. When we step into the public square, when we enter into the debates of our time, are others still inspired to sing our songs? Are they still moved by the melody of our refrains? Would others find our public witness to be so clear and profound that non-believers could recite it themselves with precision? Or is it cloudy, pedestrian, or harsh? The Christians who James Weldon Johnson was around found justice and righteousness to be the foundation of God's throne. And they understood that they were called to take part in God's work. They understood that we serve a God of justice who places these issues in our sphere of influence so that we can do a work that glorifies him. And so what I'm getting at is opportunities that we see within the civic space, within politics, provide us an opportunity to do a great work for God. And if we start off from there, I think we'll end up in a better place as well. So as we search for answers to the problems that afflict our society today, the conversation must address what teachings we will follow and what methods we'll employ to achieve our objectives. I want to put this down. Excuse me for a second. So again, we have to look at, we have to talk about what methods we'll employ and what teachings we will follow to pursue politics in the way that is biblical. And unfortunately, I think today Christians have been, in some instances, seduced by political ideologies that are made by human hands and really can't withstand biblical scrutiny. I think to a certain extent, the Bible speaks to this. If we look at Ephesians 4, verses 14 through 15, Paul says this. He says, "Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ." Speaking the truth in love. Now, when he talks about people in their deceitful scheming, the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming, it sounds a lot like politics, reminiscent of politics to me. Now, here Apostle Paul is talking to the church of Ephesus, which was the persevering church. Ephesus had endured a lot of suffering and also had false prophets who were trying to infiltrate the church with false teachings. Earlier in Ephesians 4, Paul talks about being mature. And the way he uses mature here, he's talking about growth in mind and understanding, growth in knowledge of the truth, and growth in moral character. So when he says when we mature, he's saying when we're no... Oh, thank you. Perfect. It's a lot better. So again, he's talking about growth in knowledge of the truth, growth in moral character, and so on. So he says, once we mature, once we grow in knowledge of the truth, then we will no longer be infants, meaning we will no longer be as malleable, impressionable, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching. I'm sure all of us know someone who they read one book on an issue, and now their whole opinion has changed when there's a whole bunch of books out there, right? We know that happens quite a lot. Or they watch one video, and now they think totally differently about something. But what Paul is saying here is that mature Christians aren't easily deceived in that way. These false teachers wouldn't be able to indoctrinate mature Christians because mature Christians know what they stand for, right? So regardless of what false teachings are prominent, regardless of what's going on in pop culture, regardless of how much you are suffering, and that's the tough one, regardless of how much you are suffering, mature Christians should be able to speak the truth in love. Christians ought not let our circumstances dictate who we are. And it's interesting because everyone these days wants to talk about the civil rights movement, but I'm not sure that everybody understands even what some of the main principles in the civil rights movement were. Yes, the civil rights movement was about changing policy. Yes, it was about changing systems. Yes, it was about changing institutions. But there was something that was even more important than that. And what it was that regardless of what you were going through, regardless of what was happening, you could never allow your opposition to have a negative impact on your spirit. Because you could win all those other battles, but if they won that battle, if you lost that battle, you really lost everything. And so we can talk about Martin Luther King. Everybody can claim that mantle. But everyone doesn't want to talk about how his life taught us that it is better to die than to hate your enemies. And that's something in politics I think we could better understand or better put to practice. So we must always be able to speak the truth in love. And I don't want to come off as if political and social ideologies are all bad, because they can be useful. You can decide whether progressivism or conservatism is best in a given situation. But what I can tell you is that they are not the gospel. And so that we need to stop defending political ideologies as if they are inerrant and infallible, because we know that they are not. And we need to keep that in mind. The truth is that the two most prominent ideologies are often separate love and truth, as if love and truth are somehow in conflict or mutually exclusive. Timothy Keller put it this way. He said that love without truth is sentimentality, meaning it's overly emotional, it's lacking in substance. And truth without love is harshness, it's mean, it's uncompassionate. And many of these ideologies tend to be either lacking in love or lacking in truth. And so I want to focus in on this love and truth framework, which is the framework from Ephesians 4 that the AND campaign really uses. So let's first talk about the love side of this equation, right? As you all know, we're in a seminary. We should acquaint ourselves with systematic theology. We should know as much of the Bible as possible. But if we're unloving and uncompassionate in our public witness or in the policy that we support, then we're not being Christ-like. And some could say there's a criticism, a general criticism, that this is where some conservatives run into trouble, right? We've been commanded to love our neighbor as ourselves. And you can't do that if you're not willing to advocate for your neighbor's well-being and to protect their human dignity. That's really all the biblical definition of social justice is. If you would want it, if you would seek justice for yourself, then you should want it and seek it for others. And so many of you know that we had this debate in 2018, and some of you may have participated in that debate about social justice, with many Christians saying it wasn't something that Christians should be involved with. And so we had Christians who were saying that we don't want to really engage social justice. But I'll be honest, I think everyone cares about social justice. I don't believe that anybody in this room today doesn't care about social justice. I think some of us limit it to the people we care about and may deny it to others. And let me give you an example. No one in here is going to sit around and watch someone they love be unjustly imprisoned if they can stop it. You're not going to sit and watch that, right? No one's going to know that their child is going to a school where their child is being mistreated and not do anything about it. And certainly, no one's going to allow the kids in their neighborhood, the kids in their community, to drink lead-poisoned water if there's something you could do to stop it. Why is that? Because you believe in social justice. You believe that society should set certain standards for how people should be treated based on human dignity, based on the Imago Dei, right? But what we find is that justice can be very hard. Justice can be tougher than some of the other things we engage in. This is why we're willing to give people charity long before we give them justice, right? Because justice means that the systems that benefit us might be disrupted. Justice demands a conflict with self-interest. Justice might just uproot and dismantle the very foundation and podium upon which we stand to look down on others. You see, justice lifts up God and subordinates the power of men. Christian politics without an emphasis on love and social concern creates a harsh and hypocritical civic witness that excludes and marginalizes certain groups. Christian politics that subordinate or dismiss justice is not a perspective based on biblical principles. It's really a perspective based on secular ideology. It's hard for me to see how you can look through the gospel, you could read through Isaiah and see justice, 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 and not think that that's part of God's work. And as a servant of God, you wouldn't take part in that work, right? Now let's look at the truth side of this conversation. In Ephesians 4:15, the term speak the truth comes from the Greek word that refers to teaching or professing the truth, often as it relates to doctrine. So this is not subjective, right? Everyone does not have their own truth. I, as someone from the traditional black church, don't have my own truth, and you have a separate truth. There is one truth, right? And so to speak the truth in this context means to profess right doctrine or to be honest in how you recount events. We worship a God of moral order. God's truth provides us with direction and structure. And in an ever-changing world, it is unchanging, right? Now, in the urban setting, especially somebody that was a strategist in the urban setting, you understand that everybody wants to be progressive or called progressive, although you really don't know exactly what that means. I remember I would go into certain, you know, I'd be promoting a certain issue or a certain candidate, running a certain candidate's campaign. I would say, this candidate is the most progressive candidate in the race. Everybody goes crazy. What does that really even mean, though, right? So, and this is where some progressives get into trouble when you're talking about truth. Because to move forward and to fix things can be good. But being progressive is not the answer in every situation, right? If you're on the edge of a cliff, to progress or to even lean forward probably isn't a good idea, right? Or if you're already going in the wrong direction, it also probably isn't such a good idea to continue to progress. We have to understand that sometimes God is asking us to stand firm on his word and preserve things and institutions that he's already established as good, right? Modern thought tells us that we can improve on everything, but God's truth cannot be improved, right? You can think of it sort of like a Picasso, right? You can't improve on a Picasso, right? You can only deface a Picasso. Right. If you go up to this masterpiece with a brush, a paintbrush and some kind of eraser, let's say, I don't care how great of an artist you think you are. If you add anything to that masterpiece or you take anything away from that masterpiece, you have made it worse. Right. You haven't improved it at all. And that's the way that we have to start seeing God's truth. But when we talk about progressivism, like always being progressive is the way to go in these urban spaces, I think we're missing a huge point about what God has already established as good. So Christian politics that puts faith first has to seek to renew what man has distorted and preserve what God has established as good. We can't be so progressive that we're exchanging the truth for confusion and moral order for chaos, right? So we have to see both of those sides. We talked about the love side of it. If we're not loving, you can be as knowledgeable as you want to be, but you lack that compassion. Right. If you're not understanding the truth, you're going into a place of chaos and away from moral order. And I think Jesus demonstrated how to live out this love and truth synergy in society. He was concerned about the marginalized individuals in society, but he didn't simply patronize them with sentimentality. He attended to them with love and truth. In John 8, the case of the adulterous woman who was about to be stoned, he says, go. Which was him liberating her from these hypocrites, kind of who were intent on hurting her, releasing her from this societal bondage, if you will. But he didn't stop there. He also said, sin no more, because the other half of the truth was that she would never be completely free unless she had a heart change and she turned away from sin. Right. So it couldn't be just be this liberation when you have some internal issues that you're dealing with as well. Similarly, in John 8, the lame man was told to stand up and walk and then later told to stop sinning. Right. The woman wasn't only a victim of external bondage, but also an internal bondage. The man's infirmity wasn't only an outward disability. Right. There was another matter that had to be dealt with by inward transformation. But too many Christians today, I think, embrace ideologies that are very keen on identifying how others have sinned against us while blinding us to how we're being devoured by our own sin, right? If the adulterous woman were here today, one side of the political spectrum with Christians would say, stone her for she has broken the law, right? The other side would say, slay queen, live your truth. And both would be leaving her in chains, right? Both would be leaving her imprisoned. This was not the pedagogic creed of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Can you imagine the lame man sitting there needing to be healed and asking God to be healed? And he says, no, live your truth, man. You're good. Live your truth. I'm not going to heal you. You live your truth, right? So we have to start seeing the flaws in our side of the argument, in our side of the conversation. If you can't see those flaws as a Christian, you have some issues and you probably need to step back for a while and kind of analyze what's going on. So as someone whose ministry focuses on this intersection between faith and politics, I really have the peculiar commission of emphasizing the importance of politics as a means of loving our neighbors and seeking the common good, while in the same breath de-emphasizing, right, or subordinating politics in the mind and the heart of the believer who's treating it as an ultimate thing. So to say, yes, politics is very important, but it's not all important. To explain that if we ignore the political realm, then we're bad stewards. But if we unduly elevate it, then we've handed to Caesar what belongs to God. To encourage believers to engage with determination and passion while not losing their Christian identity in the fray. Believers must be able to speak, regardless of what party you're in. We must be able to engage politics with clarity, credibility, and courage. We must pursue social justice, a biblical version of social justice, and contend against the supposed sovereignty of self-expression. Right? We'll need to do both of those things in order to be more faithful in politics. And the AND campaign is an effort to do that. So we first stand for the proposition that faith must be at the center of Christian civic engagement, and that we must ultimately transcend partisanship and political ideology. Now, those things might be helpful tools, right? So they may be helpful tools, but they can never be the masters of our social action, right? The AND campaign is also a response, as I talked about earlier, to how our fallen society tends to separate love and truth. You know, how it separates them, it divides them as if they're mutually exclusive or somehow at odds. You know, one side of the political spectrum is supposedly all about love. The other side claims to be all about truth, and we're chose to choose between the two. And I come to tell you today, brothers and sisters, that that is a false choice. A Christian can choose a political party. There's nothing wrong with that. A Christian cannot choose between love and truth. Our civic engagement must be both love and truth, justice and moral order. And the AND campaign literally stands for compassion and conviction, justice and righteousness. I think you get the point. Which means that we would advocate on behalf of the poor and on behalf of the sanctity of life. Now, those two issues might seem incompatible in partisan terms, but we see no contradiction. We see consistency. If the Bible is both love and truth, then we see an incompleteness or an imbalance when one of those is absent. So through raising civic literacy among believers, coalition building, and being a Christian advocacy resource, we are determined to disrupt America's sociopolitical arena for the better. And what's necessary to do that is nothing less than a paradigm shift within the church, right? A completely different way of perceiving and engaging politics. You see, the AND campaign truly believes that at certain times and on certain issues, Christian principles compel us to defy both political conservatism and political progressivism. And here's what I mean. When conservatism means preserving unjust systems and institutions, it must be opposed. As simple as that. When progressivism means moving further and further away from God's truth, it too must be opposed. Because when it comes to political ideology, to be conservative at all times or to be progressive at all times and on every single issue is not only intellectually lazy. So let's establish that. And easily manipulated, we would say that it's not faithful. You see, theological conservatism and ideological conservatism are not always the same thing. The far left's conception of social justice isn't always consistent with a biblical understanding. Therefore, Christians can't confine themselves to the limits of either of these ideologies. Because again, these ideologies were made with human hands. They're often controlled by hidden agendas and fueled by indecent exchanges. Christian engagement should not be constrained by secular categories. Certain issues might call for a position that appears to be progressive, while others call for a more conservative stance. You can characterize it however you would like. But you got to make sure that you're being faithful, right? Our objective is faithfulness, not partisan loyalty or ideological obedience. And when you think about it, what really is partisan loyalty at the end of the day? What does that mean to us if we say that you can be in a party, but what is partisan loyalty to you? Does it mean that we would support a party when they have bad behavior, when they have bad policy? When I look out and look at Christians who are partisan, that's pretty much what I see. Defending your tribe or your party regardless because you can't lose. So I would question those of us who are entering politics with some type of serious partisan loyalty. Because at the end of the day, if we're conservative, when the issue calls for a change or the dismantling of old prejudice structures, then we're helping to maintain injustice, right? If we're progressive when the moment calls for the regeneration or preservation of moral order, then we are complicit in society's rejection of truth. Those things can't be maintained and maintain the gospel. If you take progressivism or conservatism to its logical conclusion, I would say that you're far outside of the gospel. And I think we need to recognize that. So we cannot be political zombies. We must be more thoughtful about how we participate in politics, because again, politics is not tic-tac-toe. Politics is chess. It's more than what you see on the surface. There's a lot going on. So in understanding the love and truth, the compassion and conviction, it allows us to be nimble and forward-thinking to ensure that we're on the right side of history. And I'm not talking about errant human history. I'm talking about redemptive history. And at the same time, we must stand firm on God's truth when it is under assault, right? We have a choice. We can stand like Amos, or we can be like Amaziah the priest who pandered for affirmation and proximity to power. We must pursue the well-being even of our enemies, and we talked about that earlier, and support non-believers who are seeking to do the right thing. But when it comes to politics, our alliances must always be strategic and conditional, honest, yet shrewd. Now, in order for us to be faithful as a body, we can no longer allow our politics to divide us racially. And this is a really big part of the conversation. It doesn't mean that we're going to agree on every issue. We may always disagree on the marginal tax rate, but I think that's okay. We should be able to work together on issues that are dealing directly with biblical principles. There should be no excuse for not being able to do that, because what's happening is the church's shameful racial divide is coupled with and aggravated by the socio-political divide, which I call the politics of division. Outside the walls of the church, Christians have staked out positions based on divergent political and ideological preferences and have placed those preferences above Christian principles in some instances. So through whether it's racist dog whistles or the naked exploitation of identity, the political landscape draws Christians into these secular tribes, meanwhile moving us further apart from each other, right? And we allow this to happen. As a consequence, we continue to reflect the world's divides and spread the world's infection rather than curing it. We see Christians in the public square who are trading insult for insult, defending leaders who demean and dehumanize suffering people, believers reveling in iniquity. We only laugh at outcomes that make our political opponents cry. We're only kind and compassionate towards those who fit a particular profile and only acknowledge truth that fits our narrative. And we're so busy, and this is a big one, we are so busy trying to prove ourselves worthy of the affirmation of our ideological tribes that sometimes we can't even articulate the basic fundamental Christian precept about what it looks like to love our enemies. How do we apply that in politics? See, one side, I think, disconnects its faith from its immigration policy, concealing the ethic that requires us to be humane before being pragmatic and self-interested. And we see the other side on the left is really a lot of my peers are really just repeating after some of these kind of pseudo-militant academics who are now calling for an end of civility, which sounds fashionably radical and revolutionary until you realize that you're not prepared for such a state of engagement and that some of the people that are being uncivil with you wish that you would be go to a state of a society that was uncivil, right? And many aren't prepared for that. I mean, let's think about it. The weaker people in society, it amazes me that you would call for incivility, right? How do you even have a voice in a society that has no civility? Why would you call for civility? But it's not about thinking these things through. It's just about following the tribe and repeating the tribe once that's once they've decided that's what they want to do. Now, I will admit, I think civility needs to be better defined because it isn't a call to be subdued or docile. But the alternative leads to intimidation and violence. And so I think that leaders on the left who are calling for an end of civil discourse from ivory towers without revealing the costs are reckless and irresponsible. Where will they be when this leads to more children bleeding on the concrete? So here's a question that we have to think about from the racial intersection with the sociopolitical arena. How is it that black and white Christians and other Christians of color can't find common ground? Right? We have believers on both sides who share the same faith, who read the same Sermon on the Mount, who share the same Great Commission, who are obligated to abide by the same great requirement and the same great commandment. They share the same destiny and who are required to die to self in the same way. Yet for some reason, we can't see that our shared Christian principles are our common ground. That's where our common ground is. History shows us that Christian civic engagement can be used to advance the common good. Again, I would cite the civil rights movement and the abolition of slavery as examples of that. But we've also witnessed politics distort the faith and seen Christianity be used to support agendas and people that are unjust and unrighteous. From this, we can conclude that politics isn't inherently good or bad. It's neutral. It's the principles and motives behind the politics that make it positive or negative in any particular instance. And we've embraced political allies that I believe have motives and agendas that need to be questioned. Right. If we go over to Acts 19, verses 24 through 27, we see this. It says, a silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in a lot of business for the craftsmen there being Ephesus. He called them together along with the workers in related trades and said, you know, my friends, that we receive a good income from this business. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that gods made by human hands are no gods at all. There is a danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty. He says that gods made by human hands are no gods at all. After this meeting, a riot ensued. The Bible says that the assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another. Most of the people didn't even know why they were there. Sounds familiar. In Acts 13 and 14, as Paul and Barnabas zealously preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, they continually come into conflict with those whose interests are endangered by the love and truth of the good news. Continually. In Paphos, they had to go toe-to-toe with the false prophet and sorcerer Elymas, rebuking his works and prophecies in the name of God. In Iconium, when they preached the same word that had just gotten them kicked out of Pisidian Antioch, by an organized mob. This time, the Jews and the Gentiles were provoked, formed another mob that forced the apostles to flee, later catching up with them in Lystra, where they were stoned, where they were stoned, and Paul was drugged through the city. Now, to combat this politics of division, I really think that Christians have to decide whether they're going to take the posture of Apostle Paul and Barnabas, or we're going to run with the mob. Because what we see in our political landscape right now is just mobs running wild and Christians following behind them. The Christian approach will in all likelihood place you at odds with the mob, right? Paul and Barnabas weren't looking to be adversarial necessarily, but their message was so powerful that it threatened those who benefit from iniquity. You see, because when the gospel enters into a toxic culture, it's an immediate threat. Right. This is what Demetrius was worried about. lies are exposed, and emperors are disrobed. When the gospel comes into a dysfunctional environment and people begin to see the mechanisms of immorality and injustice for what they really are, the entire societal order is subject to be rearranged. This is why Demetrius was like, we have to get this guy out of here. We have to get Paul out of here. He's going to ruin everything, right? In short, when the gospel is present in earnest, it must be accounted for. These were two guys coming into a toxic situation, and Demetrius knew, we've got to do something. This guy has to go, right? But here's the question. If the gospel comes into indecent settings and can't help but be disruptive, then why are Christians having the opposite impact on our corroded political system? Why is it that when Christians get political, we're the converts instead of the evangelists? The problem is that our political participation has become mob-centered instead of being gospel-centered. We've separated our faith from our politics, and as a consequence, our political and ideological affiliations have become religious in nature. One of the things that we found with the AND campaign, when we challenge the church on something, people love it. We get the most retweets. I mean, people love when you challenge the church. When we challenge somebody's party, now you've gone too far. And these are Christians. When we challenge the party, people really get upset, or the ideology, they really get upset. But they'll allow you to challenge the church all day. Why is that? Right? The people on both sides of the political spectrum that benefit from chaos benefit from the division within Christianity. And regardless of what party you're in, you better believe there's people in your party that benefit from you not coming together with other Christians, that benefit from you saying you watching television and making assumptions about them instead of joining hand in hand and talking through the issue. They spend millions of dollars to make sure that a coalition like that never comes together, right? Because at that point, their gods and their idols made with human hands start to fall apart. But we have to be big enough to see through that and to still work together. And I'll say this. I think this is one of the most important statements. I truly believe that hyperpartisanship and absolute ideological purity are idols made by human hands that incite mobs. So if you're an ideological pure Christian, you might want to think twice whether these are idols that you are following behind, because somebody is in the lab coming up with talking points, looking at the data that says, if I say this many times, this is how they react. And we do that, right? We react the way that they expect us to. The Bible, again, says that the people that took part in the riot in Ephesus were confused, and most of them didn't even know why they were there. A lot of times if you go to the protests or you go to certain things today and you ask people, why are you here? Explain it to me. They can't even explain it. But they know they're passionate about it. They know something went wrong, and they know that the people they don't like are against whatever they're doing at the moment, right? We've got to be more sophisticated than that. But I'll end this way. We have to understand that mobs have always been profitable for tyrants and frauds, right? Because there's no critical thinking within a mob, right? There's no higher principles within a mob. Don't be fooled. Some of the movements we see today on both sides, they're not about justice. They're about vengeance. They're about blood, seeking blood, right? They don't judge people based on the content of their character. They judge them on group identity and prosecute on that basis alone. Mobs don't have to be consistent. They don't have to be historically accurate. All they have to do is pick the right target, and we're all in. We're ready to join them. Mobs no longer try to win debates, right? They simply come up with buzzwords that can reduce a complicated matter into a no-brainer. You don't have to think about this, right? And mobs certainly don't reconcile with the other side. Never. Because the other side will never change. The other side is evil. They're demonic. The person on the other side doesn't have a story, a testimony, a struggle. They're just hateful or lazy or a waste of space. No one reconciles with a character. And the worst thing that you can suggest to a mob is self-examination, especially through a biblical lens. You will be immediately attacked. Because a mob can only survive if its heroes, narratives, and idols go unquestioned. And so as Christians enter into political conversations, into political parties, into ideological tribes, we must be the ones raising those critical questions. We must be Paul in Ephesus, letting people know that this isn't safe. This is disruptive. The Christians, if we present something new in our agenda, the Christians aren't just going to go along with it, right? The Christians may have a problem, and they may even do things that are against self-interest, which throws the whole election off or throws whatever we're trying to get off. Because we have to be more about our principles and not what I've called the politics of self-interest. Christian politics is sacrificial. It's looking out for others, even those who are our enemies, which means we will lose sometimes. And so I'll end with this. Christians and politics have to be about this clear and profound witness. A witness that someone like James Weldon Johnson, who isn't even a believer, could repeat and recite with precision. Because it was so clear and it was so profound. That's what Christian politics needs to look like. It has to be about the witness before the win. Because the witness and the win often come into conflict. And which one wins out among Christians tells us what we really believe. Thanks for having me.
The witness before the win. That's a bumper sticker. Or a tweet. You need a mic. Can you grab that one? Yeah. Well, I have lots of questions, I appreciate that so much. One of the things that I appreciate about you and the AND campaign and all who work with it, and it's embedded in the ethos of the AND campaign, is that civic disengagement is civil, and which is what, speaking the truth in love, you can't be advocating for the imago Dei of this group of people while you rip down the image of God in another. That's not the way the gospel works. And so I appreciate that so much about how you engage. And I'm going to ask a couple of questions, but we do have a mic set up if anybody would like to come forward and ask. I have like 7 questions, to be honest with you, but I'll try and limit myself while you guys, come up with yours. The first one I want to ask is something that's a part of a large conversation that is a bizarre intersection. It's a bizarre crossroads. And it's the concept of Christians talking about socialism. Socialism is historically hostile towards religious freedom. It's kind of consistent throughout history. And when we look at different expressions of socialism around the world, even under softer expressions of socialism, that dynamic of hostility is kind of a given byproduct. Once the government is given power, thank you. Once the government's given power over the church, it naturally sets itself up as a sort of demigod, instructing the church what it can and cannot teach. How do you square this generation's push towards socialism among young Christians in particular with religious freedom? Why does it seem that so few people make this connection?
Yeah, I think for one, and I want to give voice to some of the concerns that lead to this. I think for one, they don't see the conflict, right? I think there's a lack of a historical context when we think about socialism to some extent. But to give some credence to what they're saying, or at least to give voice to what they're saying, a lot of young people are saying this because I think consumer capitalism has failed the country to some extent, right? Whether you're talking about the collapse of 2008 or whatever, consumer capitalism has not benefited a lot of people. They see their brothers, their fathers, other people out of work, kind of, being replaced and all these other things. They're saying, this isn't working. Now, that doesn't mean that socialism is better than capitalism. It just means we need an alternative because I'm getting crushed by student loans. I get out of school and I still can't get a job. This is not good, right? And so I get where that comes from. And obviously there's, you know, there's universities and leaders who are pushing this. And so that adds to it. But I think just a lack of historical perspective in thinking about religious freedom. One of the things we have to understand is there's a narrative out there that the church, and some of this is earned, but not all of it is fair. The church is always the bad guy. It's always the one pushing people around. So when we, you know, we did a tour last year where we would talk about religious exclusion and how people, Christians, are being going through what we call polite persecution, right? But because of the narratives in society, a lot of people, young people just can't see it, right? It's like, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. It doesn't go along with the narrative that I'm being taught. And so I just don't think that they see socialism in the way that they would see it if they had a historical perspective. Now, I tend to kind of agree with, you know, G.K. Chesterton always talked about how, you know, corporations and business and the government, there needs to be a balance because you don't want either of them to control too much. Right. And I think there's something to that. But I think we would miss the point if we didn't see how consumer capitalism has really failed a lot of people and left a lot of people out of the economy. And when you're looking at that and we connect it to work, we know that work is about dignity. And so when you have folks who are not working and nothing's going wrong, you're going to look and say, I mean, the assumption is that the dignity comes from the money, but the dignity really comes from the work. And when folks are out of work, they're going to look for those alternatives. And so I would say we need to make a better case for a capitalism that isn't the type of consumer capitalism that we're seeing.
An ethical capitalism.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think you could ever get to a point in your life or in your work or your ministry where the system is so corrupt that you can't participate in the political process anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I don't think we're anywhere near that right now, but I think it's possible that strategically you could say we're not going to participate, but it would have to be a part of a larger strategy, right? It wouldn't be,
right.
I'm upset, my feelings are hurt, I'm running
right,
away.
I'm going to be, yeah, I'm just going to shut everything down. No, I mean, maybe more towards a position of extreme innovation. And reframing of how Christians engage in the public square.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's possible.
That's what you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be, you know, like I said, there has to be a paradigm shift in how we look at politics. And again, politics is chess. And so there's a lot of, you know, potential, there's a lot of potential to do a lot of different things based on what's going on, you know, on the chessboard. But generally, I think Christians have to see the civic space as an opportunity to love their neighbor and to protect human dignity. Because if we don't do that, if we just stand back and watch people be treated any kind of way because we're upset or because we don't have the exact candidate we like, then we're really just hurting people.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it can be somewhat prideful while there's people suffering. And if there's anything you can do to help, you need to try to help. And politics is a good tool for that. But it's a tool, not something that should be our identity.
You make me think of the classic. This is my area of research, but you make me think of the classic Wurmbrand stories, Richard Wurmbrand, and you know we see this even in China today. There are people who are Christians who have infiltrated the Communist Party. They've infiltrated these, and they're working from inside, and they're often misunderstood by their families because they're like, oh, you're on the other side because they're working in stealth. There has to be a room for Daniels.
I mean, there's precedent in the Bible, right?
Exactly. Yeah, Daniels and Nehemiahs, you know, people who are working inside the system. But I think that they're most powerful when they know that politics is not there's no salvation in politics.
Right.
It's not the only answer and it's not the supreme and ultimate answer, but we do have a responsibility. And there are people who are legitimately called to that.
Right. And working inside the system isn't affirming the system.
Right.
Right, or being in a certain party isn't affirming that party. The way that I look at parties, I guess we'll get to that a little later. I'll hold up.
Well, we can go there now if you want.
Yeah, no, I said the way that I look at parties is people say, well, how can you be in this party? How you can be in that party? Because it's not my identity, right? If I'm using this as a tool strategically, it may make more sense for me to be in this party because that's where most of the people that I live are in that party. Or that's where I have the most influence.
Right.
But if it's not part of my identity, why does it really matter? You know, why is it a big deal? If I'm not supporting everything that they put in front of me, it's not as big of a deal, but we assume that this is part of your identity. And that's, I think that is the problem, rather than just a strategic move on the chessboard that you have to get to human flourishing, to get to the protection of human dignity.
You know who breaks that down really well is Vince Bacot in The Political Disciple. And it's a really nice little tome. It's really accessible. Yeah, check it out. Taking a Kuyperian approach to political engagement. For the Christian. All right, let me hip these guys to something that you were fairly close proximity to the Kelvin Cochran legal case here in Atlanta, and you can give a brief history on how that went down. And then just this past week, we saw the first black female president of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Kay Coles James, was vilified in the public square by some employees at Google. I don't know if you guys followed that story. She was appointed to a board to discuss artificial intelligence and was rejected for her personal religious convictions regarding traditional marriage, but also for Heritage's political conservative stance on immigration and climate change. So in that story, there was a small number of LGBTQ leaders who rallied to her defense for free speech and thought, but the court of public opinion was fairly intolerant if you watched it on social media. For a lot of activists today, in those situations, disagreement, even compassionate disagreement, equals hatred. I would certainly put James and Kelvin Cochran on the spectrum of compassionate disagreement. Talk a little bit about the power of cultural opinion in relation to our responsibility to speak and live our Christian, traditional Christian conviction. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think we should always understand the spirit of the day, right? And when you see Paul in the Agora, you know, he's using the Socratic method. He's doing all these things. He understands how they communicate. He understands the rhetorical devices they use, the spirit of the day, and that makes it more effective. So we need to understand those things, but we can't be of the spirit of the day, right? We can't feed into those things to where they control us. And I think what you're seeing right now is in academia and other places is this idea that words can be violence has changed the whole discourse, right? So if words can be violence, then anything you say that I don't agree with just shouldn't be said, right? And we don't even have to argue about it. We don't need to have a conversation. It made me feel a certain way. And I think what happened here is, you know, C.S. Lewis, my favorite quote from C.S. Lewis is he says that the enemy sends errors in pairs. And he uses one error to send you into the other error. And so I think what we see here is when you have a time when, whether it be conservatives, Christians, or whoever, we're somewhat harsh, right? We're somewhat not compassionate towards others. People see that, and I think we've gone to the total other side of things where now everybody's hypersensitive, right? Now everything's catastrophic. Everything just breaks my bone. You know, everything breaks me, and I think that's the wrong way to go. It's almost like we went from, you know, some people being harsh to saying, almost glorifying this fragility. You know, glorifying the fact that, okay, you're going to sit in your room for 2 weeks because somebody said something you didn't like. You know, society can't operate if you can't have open discourse and you can't have a conversation because somebody's feelings are hurt. And I would say to some of my peers, this is the opposite of what was happening in the civil rights movement. Can you imagine if Dr. King stopped talking or stopped going somewhere because somebody had hurt his feelings based on what they said? Now, words matter. I'm not saying they don't matter. But can you imagine if Fannie Lou Hamer said, you know what, I'm not actually going to go here anymore and speak the truth because they're going to say stuff that hurts my feelings. No, she was getting beat over the head with real violence.
Right.
And she still went and did all those things. Right. So that's not the spirit of the civil rights movement. It was more of an anti-fragility to say, no, I'm strong enough. I'm going to overcome these things. Rather than just saying that hurt me. Oh, it hurt you. How can we coddle you and make sure you're okay? I get that to a certain extent, but it goes too far. And so I think, again, when you go into this words as violence, it just ends the conversation. And especially I think, you know, and we can get to the right on this because I think they have some issues. But on the left particularly, because that's in the space where I'm at, there's been such an effort to shut off debate, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's because, oh, you have this identity. Oh, you can't talk about it. You said it the wrong. You used the wrong word. Oh, no, you can't talk anymore. Right. It's not about furthering the debate and winning the conversations. It's about making sure that we shut as many people out of the debate so we don't have to have the conversation. And that's just it's just dangerous. And I think Christians have to reject that. And we have to reject while caring for people who have been gone through trauma, because that's real. We have to reject this fragility and the celebration of every time somebody says something on Twitter I don't like, I'm going to just explode. It's catastrophic. And I can't go on right now. It's really dramatic. And I think it's just not helpful to what we're doing because it causes us to be focused on the wrong things and it shuts down debate.
Since words matter, you and I have differed in the past on use of terms, and we differed amicably, which is, you know, practicing civil engagement. We've differed in the past on the very term social justice. In my way of thinking, the term has been fairly clearly defined by Rauschenbosch and that school of thought, whose definition excludes the most important element of the gospel for kingdom building, which is the transformative element that's found in Jesus Christ through union with Christ. That's the element that keeps a person who's been cheated, oppressed, from becoming a tyrant themselves, right? So that's a necessary component. Of course, you know I prefer the term biblical justice, which you did a beautiful job showing us, you know, where those are in the scripture, where they're buried. And biblical justice obviously carries social implications, religious freedom, right, not just to life, but to abundant life from womb to tomb, the right to disagree and agree, how Christians should participate in all of these processes in a biblical way. All of these lead to gospel-changing, life-impacting social equity in some way, shape, or form. Tell us why you prefer personally the term social justice, if the term biblical justice would do.
Yeah. So for one, I don't think the far left owns. I don't want to allow them to own the word social justice, because from my context, you know, the traditional Black church, that is used quite a bit, and so I don't see them as owning it. But something else is that you have to meet people where they are, right? And so biblical justice off top, people are triggered or whatever. Okay, let's use your term if that's what you want to do, and I'm going to almost co-opt or bring back the term to where it needs to be, right? So social justice communicates to society a certain thing, right? And I think we need to communicate that. And going back to Apostle Paul in Acts 17, to me, that's what he was doing. He was speaking to people on their terms. He was meeting them where they were at, but then he was adding something to it, right? So we never talk about just social justice. You'll never hear me just talk about social justice and not talk about moral order, right? Like, I don't believe in having that conversation and talking for 30 minutes and not talking about the moral order or the righteousness that goes along with that. But what I do when I talk about the social justice, I invite you into the space and we have an agreement in terms, so to speak, and then you can hear the rest of what I have to say, right? If I go in talking in terms that people don't normally use, you're going to get a whole group of people who might be willing to hear you who are just like, nah, I don't want to hear it, because you don't get the immediacy of justice, that justice isn't just ultimate justice, that there's a justice that happens in society. So I want to give voice to that, but also let them know that it's bigger than that by itself.
So it's a teaching and apologetic tool for you, the term is,
to some
a lot
extent,
of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, great. Would you step up to the mic? Because we are recording this. So, yes, welcome.
First of all, thanks for speaking. So my wife and I have had some pretty lively debates about the term social justice. And one of the things I would love to hear your thoughts on is, why do we have to add a word before justice? Because it seems like if we are wanting to achieve equity, that and we don't have time to go into some of the other things about the role of government, et cetera, because I do have questions for you on that stuff as well. But why do we need to add social in front of justice?
We don't need to if we want to be technical. But as I said before, that's what society talks about. That's what society refers to. So when you see the AND campaign and you see social justice and moral order, people already get to some extent what that social justice means, right? Justice can be a little more vague. It's not used as much. It's not as specific, right, for some people. And so we want to use that terminology that really says, oh, that really interests me. Well, I've drawn you into this conversation. Now you're going to have to deal with moral order and how there can be no justice or social justice without moral order, right? But I've drawn you into that conversation without rejecting you from it. And I just don't think the word by itself is a negative, right? I don't think it has to be a pejorative, because I don't allow, you know, those elements to own it. And so we're saying, no, that's actually ours. And if you're going to say the civil rights movement was about social justice, well, then let me tell you what the other parts of the civil rights movement were about and what really sustained it. So technically, we don't have to. I mean, we're not getting deep into being technical. It's kind of the difference between talking in academia and talking to the people, right? They're going to understand it a different way, and I think they understand it. And I don't have to do a whole bunch of extra explaining, but I can bring in more order and put a whole nother spin on it.
That's interesting. If I may ask one more thing. I just recently watched a video that the UN did, and they asked a bunch of different world leaders and a bunch of different officials what social justice meant to them. And it was very, very different from the definition that you gave and the definition that, you know, folks that I know use. Specifically, you know, my wife, you know, the way that she thinks about it is from your perspective. She uses the definition that you use. But it seems like the entire rest of the world uses a different definition. And unless you're there to explain what you mean by that, they take it as you meaning what they mean. And it seems like there's a consensus on what that means. And it has a lot of it adds a lot of things to it that I don't think are necessarily compatible with a Christian worldview, and especially a Christian approach to the role of government. How do you deal with that? Because there's an overwhelming consensus in the rest across the world about what that means.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the basic troubles you run into when it comes to politics in the English language, right? I mean, this is not perfect and the most precise way to go about it. But I think for the constituency who we're trying to reach and who we're speaking to, they get what we're saying. So it's a context matter. I don't know. I don't know that I would agree that it's widely understood outside the church and inside the church as the same thing. Because I think if you go to my church, they would understand that maybe a lot differently than someone else's church understood it, right? And so we're just starting from a place where you're using a word that a lot of people are using. Now, if you come listen to me, let's speak, and the way I use social justice and talk about moral order and righteousness, you can very much tell that I'm not using the same one that the secular progressives would be using. And so is it a perfect way to go about it? Probably not. But I think for us, it's communicated what needs to be communicated, because I can't only reach, I'm not only talking at RTS, I'm talking to kids who are in Black Lives Matter, who are in the women's movement, and they need to hear that we have some common ground as I bring them into this conversation about why it's bigger than what they've been talking about.
And to be fair, I think that if the term, you know, if you had chosen to use just the simple term justice, you would still have to offer a definition of exactly what you mean by that. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
Justin, first of all, you do a wonderful job of articulating kind of how I think a lot of us feel, and we don't really have had trouble putting words to it. So thank you for doing that so well. As a pastor, the last presidential election was obviously very, whatever word you want to put right there. And so we are trying to think ahead a little bit to 2020 and how to kind of carefully counsel and shepherd our people. And one of the big questions that people have often is, how could you vote for someone who believes in X? Or how could you vote for someone who believes in Y? And so how do you counsel people on, A, kind of their role in voting for, especially a presidential election, when they have convictions that differ from the candidate? And then B, when is it our role to kind of counsel people away from both candidates?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I would do, and thank you for the compliments, I appreciate that. The first thing I try to do is put it in perspective, that the presidential election is big, it's not everything. And it's actually the end of a process rather than the beginning of a process. So if we're actually looking at local politics, which is actually has a lot more direct impact on the people around me, let's talk about what we can do with that. A lot of that's not even partisan, right? So what are we doing there? What are we doing on the state level? Let's have this conversation so we don't feel like this one vote is everything. And if I don't vote for the exact right person, or if you don't vote for the person I like or has one issue that I really, really don't like, then it's over, right? So I think put it in perspective to say this is important, and we're gonna be building up to this process so that we try to get the person that we want. But if you look at this last election, I mean, what are you going to do, right? I mean, it was very hard. I mean, it's not like you had a great option and people can say you had a terrible one, right? And so it was just tough. We have to make tough decisions. and different people say, you know what, there's two issues that I'm really serious about. This candidate has one and not the other. And sometimes it's our context. Sometimes it's the tradition we come from. And you have to respect if somebody can break down to you, I voted for this person for this reason, even though I didn't agree with them on abortion or something else. It's not the ultimate thing, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's important and we should have that dialogue. But people have to make a decision at some point. You don't have to, but usually you're going to make a decision at some point. It's not going to be the perfect one. Work on all the myriad of other things that we could be doing in the civic space, and that helps us understand when we have one disagreement on one vote, right, rather than all the things we could be working together to do. As far as when somebody shouldn't vote at all, I don't think we should, you know, my preference would be ideally that we worked as a body when it comes to these kind of votes, right, when it comes to politics generally. And so an individual, whether you do it or not, I mean, it matters, but it's not that big of a deal. I would like to have a larger conversation given the circumstance, and as a body or a coalition, we say, okay, on this one, it's best for us not to participate. I think that's very extreme, right? But it's something that we should talk about as a body rather than just as individuals making individual choices. Not that we have to agree on everything, but should be a larger dialogue, a larger strategy that goes along with it.
Thank you. I'd like to just dovetail off what Drew was saying too, because what we find is a lot of times we'll have people who are passionate about mercy and then forget the justice, which I think Aquinas said is just disillusion. And then justice without mercy, which is just cruelty. And so that's where I'd love for you to just maybe talk just for a second more, because you led into it about your engagement with politics and with our faith. And I loved how you ended your lecture, but that's kind of where a lot of people we felt landed with the previous election, is we looked at it and we said, we don't feel like it's either one is, so I'm just going to step back. But then you feel, well, what is our engagement with politics?
Right.
If that's what you just choose to do, if we're handed a losing card almost on both sides.
And the one thing you can look at too, so it's bigger than that one vote again. And you could say, you know what, I'm going to vote for the Republican president, but I don't want them to run and get everything they want. I'm going to vote for the Democrat senator or something like that, right? So when you make it bigger than that one vote, because there are other races and things going on and other ways we can have an impact, it's bigger. And then sometimes as a body, we just have to make a statement. I supported this person not because I agree with this, 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 and this, so there's no confusion. I supported them because of this. And I'm going to be the number one person, since I voted for this person, I'm going to be the number one person in my group pushing back against this person, because I don't want them to do the things that I'm worried about, rather than saying, I push the button and whatever happens, happens, right? But when it comes to some people wanting the mercy, some people wanting that more harsh sense of justice, you got to go to doctrine. And I think that's why, at the end of the day, that's why the AND campaign has to go back to doctrine. You know, we have to be consulting with, you know, the theologians we know and the pastors we know to say, at the end of the day, what does doctrine say you have to do, right? If you think you're more compassionate than Jesus, well, good for you, but that you can't defend that based on the gospel, right? And a lot of people, I mean, that's where, you know, they think they're more compassionate than everything that's in the gospel, but really it's just sentimentality. It's not a long view of how things work. There's a such thing as tough love. If you don't give people tough love, if you just go along with what thing they do and you tell people that they don't have to be held accountable, they're not responsible, I question whether you even love them. If you don't have truth, if you have love without truth, I question whether that is really can even be love. And so when we break it down that way, and on the other side to say, oh, you're telling somebody the truth, but it's a harsh truth. Well, how is that? Because the only reason that you're not in the same position as the person you're talking to is grace. It's not because you're such a much smarter person, a more righteous person than they are. It's because of God's grace. So is the truth that you're telling them minus grace and love, is that even the truth? Is it even a humility? Right. And then let people know. I mean, I always start those conversations off by affirming them, maybe even with criticism of the people they're criticizing. because there's usually room for that. So absolutely, I'm with you there. But what about the stuff that goes on your side? And the number one way I know somebody isn't, you know, one of my mentors said that every politics is a situation where, or a profession where everybody thinks that they're an instant expert, right? You watch CNN a couple of times, Fox News, everybody's an expert with politics. But when you listen to their analysis, you're like, if you really think your party is in the clear and does everything right, you haven't seen what I've seen, right? I'm a Democrat. I have a lot of criticisms for the Republican Party, let me tell you. But I've also seen Democrats create courts where they could just tax people to make more money for the county, right? I've seen people do that. I've seen things on the right that would never allow me to say that we're blameless. And I'm not gonna allow my party to act like it's blameless. Mm-hmm. And I think both sides need to do that. And when people see you doing that, you gain a level of credibility, because what people are really used to is just you defending your side at all costs.
That's a genuine prophetic witness, you know, is being willing to criticize. So we hear mostly of the shortcomings of America's two parties, especially as they represent each other. What do you think the two parties' better natures are?
So I think the better nature of the Republican Party is where the Democrats can be utopian. I think they better understand and admit what the human condition is and how we interact with each other. I think they're more realistic about humanity and sin and all those things and how there's a give and take on these things. I think sometimes my side of the conversation can be like, we can have it all. And, you know, people don't have to do this and do this, and it'll be a perfect utopian world. And it's like, no, there's a give and take from that, right? The more you coddle people, the less they're ready to go out into the world and do certain things. I mean, there's a lot of that. So I'll give that to the Republican Party. I think it's more realistic about humanity and the nature, you know, in our nature, sinful nature. For Democrats, I just think in general, and these are huge generalizations, as you know, but I think in general, to me, there's always been a more of a focus on the vulnerable, right? To say, at its best, is this worker being treated fairly? Yeah, it's great, and you can have your, you can make your money and do all these things, but is this worker being treated fairly? So when I tell people, I'm not a progressive in the sense of secular progressivism, right? But I am a progressive in the sense of the more classical sense of the progressive era, where you're looking out for workers, you're changing institutions because certain things are going on that shouldn't be going on. Right. Yeah. But I have to realize, as somebody who's a progressive in that way, that progressivism generally erodes structure, and it erodes structure. All structure. Right. It doesn't really discriminate in what kind of structure. So it could be good structure. Mm-hmm. It could be family structure.
Right.
Right. It could be the church as an institution or structure. Progressivism erodes those things. And I have to say, well, it's good to erode that bigotry or racism over there. It's not right. It's not good to erode something that is established and is good and is an institution that we need.
Flourishing.
Right. And that's what Christians should do. I hate when Christians say, OK, yeah, I'm a progressive, so I'm just going to go along with everything. No, you have to have a prophetic witness to say, no, that shouldn't be eroded. That shouldn't be changed. And you're not making that better.
Right.
You're not helping the people that you think you're helping.
I'm going to give you an opportunity. Oh, yes. Go ahead.
I've been waiting for an opportunity to ask this question. So with the last two statements and just this whole idea of being able to throw stones at your own party, if you will, who do you see in politics that's actually doing that well?
That's a great question.
Maybe some examples on the right and the left.
Great question.
So on the right, Ben Sasse does a little bit of that. I think that's a good one. I think Ben Sasse on the left. Oh, what's the? She's running for president. She's from Hawaii, and her name just it's Gab something.
Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think Gabbard does a pretty good job of that. Just questioning what's going on. And say, hey, we don't have to agree with this. Why aren't we being civil, right? Once a report comes out, hey, let's move on to something that's constructive instead of just harping on things because we know they get their base excited. And so I think Sasse is good in Nebraska. I think he does a good job of questioning that. Obviously not always, but he does a pretty good job of that. And Gabbard on the other side. Thank you for that name. I could not remember it.
Do you think it's possible to even run for office and remain untainted by interest or corruption or anything like that? And I mean, especially when you get up into the higher levels, there's so much. I mean, I don't know. If you watched House of Cards, murder aside, is it even possible to get into those high levels and still maintain your integrity?
Yeah, I mean, obviously nobody's going to be a perfect thesis when they go into office and do everything right. But I do think it's possible to maintain your integrity, but only if you're willing to lose.
Right.
So I don't know that it's possible to maintain it and be there for 30 years. But if you're willing to lose and you go in there and say, hey, I'm going to do what I have to do. You know, these interest groups who I don't agree with what they're doing, there's nothing they can give me to change my mind. And that's where a lot of my, because I have a lot of friends that entered into politics with values very close to mine. And once they, all they have to do is show you that you could possibly win. Like during the campaign, usually they show you, look, if we give you this $5,000, you could actually win, but you got to do this.
Right.
And it's that moment, and I've seen it over and over, it's that moment when people are like, that ambition kicks in. And that's usually what it's hard for me to talk about because I've seen it happen so many times. You got to be able to say no. Mm-hmm. I don't want it that way. And me being there isn't the same. It's not what I worked for if I can't be myself and represent who I am.
Would you like to announce your 2020 candidacy right here at the Grimke Lecture Series at the Center for the Study of the Bible and Ethnicity at RTS Atlanta?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
See, he's willing to say no. Justin, thank you. I want to invite us. We do this at the end of every series for every lecturer who comes. We just come and gather around them, and four or five people pray for them, pray for their ministry, and pray for their reaching out into our community and also on the national and even in some cases international level. So would you all come forward as we close? And once the last person says, in Jesus' name, amen, I'll close us out.